the headlines. Iran's leader highlights the significance of building good neighborly relations in a meeting with the visiting Turkmen president. Russia advises Turkey against an incursion into northern Syria as guarantor states get together in Kazakhstan to discuss a Syrian settlement. Also in our headlines, a defiant UK says it will keep working to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda after an EU court ruling grounds the first such flight. Hello and welcome, everybody. Top story for this half hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says his country's policy is to expand relations with neighbors, calling it right policy. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a meeting with visiting Turkmenistan's President Serdar Berdimuhamedov. He stressed that the expansion of ties is in the interest of both countries and urged joint commissions to seriously follow up on the implementation of agreements. Earlier, officials from both sides signed over a dozen cooperation documents in different fields. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi and his Turkmen counterpart oversaw the signing ceremony. Raisi said Iran and Turkmenistan enjoy vast capacity to boost their ties and pointed to Iran's determination to sign long-term strategic agreements. Raisi said the Tehran-Ashgabat cooperation would definitely lead to further regional development. Berdimuhamedov, for his part, said his country wants close cooperation with Tehran on issues such as the Caspian Sea legal regime. He also called for enhancing relations with Iran and international bodies. We've reached out to Central Asia Caucasus analyst Omid Rahimi for his comments. He believes there are ample capacities that can help Iran and Turkmenistan increase the volume of bilateral trade.
84% growth in the volume of trade exchanges in 2021. This is the outcome of trade exchanges by the two countries in different areas. Prior to this, the trade volume had hit a figure of $2 billion, so there are ample capacities for the growth of such exchanges. I can refer to the issue of gas. Iran, in order to meet its gas demands in northeastern part of the country, it has to import gas from Turkmenistan. The first gas export pipeline outside Central Asia was related to Iran in the 1990s. And it was at the time when Mr. Rafsanjani was the president, and there was another pipeline in 1388 Iranian calendar. It was laid in Khan Kiran, and it was used for transfer of gas to Iran. Turkmenistan, as a landlocked state, has certain limitations for the export of its gas. The recent agreements between Iran and Turkmenistan and the Republic of Azerbaijan have paved the way for other types of cooperation in this said area. That is known as the gas swap. During the visit by our oil minister to Baku, there was an agreement for doubling the volume of that gas swap. That is also an important area, and Iran can turn into a hub for the export of Turkmenistan's gas to other states.
Russia calls Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise, warning that such a move could escalate and destabilize the situation. Further, Russia's envoy to Syria made the remarks as the Kazakh capital is holding a new round of talks in the Astana format aimed at ending the Syria conflict. Alexander Lavrentiev also described relentless Israeli strikes on Syrian territories as unacceptable, saying the issue needs to be focused on the guarantor states of the Astana process for a settlement in Syria, namely Iran, Russia, and Turkey, are in attendance in Nur Sultan. There are also the representatives of the Syrian government and opposition, as well as the UN. Ankara says it plans to launch a military operation to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria. Damascus has strongly condemned the plan, saying it's part of Ankara's efforts to push for a demographic change in the area. Russia says it will open a humanitarian corridor to allow civilians encircled in a chemical plant in the eastern city of Severodonetsk to leave the area. The Russian Defense Ministry said the civilians will be evacuated to the Luhansk region, which is controlled by pro-Russia forces. The Russian military has called on Ukrainian troops in Severodonetsk to lay down arms and stop their, quote, senseless resistance by early Wednesday. Local Ukrainian officials say some 500 people have been seeking shelter in the chemical plant and are under heavy fire. The developments came after Russia destroyed all three bridges which connect Severodonetsk to the nearby city of Lysychansk. Russian forces are currently controlling 70% to 80% of Severodonetsk. The fall of the city would pave the way for Moscow to fully control the mainly Russian-speaking Donbass region. Johnny Miller is in Donetsk. He joined us earlier with the latest on the situation in Severodonetsk, the city where the fiercest clashes are taking place between Russian and Ukrainian forces.
It looks like the battle for Severodonetsk is coming to an end, but it might be in the news for at least the next few days or another week or so. Why? Because there are still civilians there and fighters from the Ukrainian army in this steel plant. It seems like a replay of what happened in Mariupol. It may well be a ploy by the Ukrainians to try and hold up the Russian advance. The Russian army said they're going to spend all day today opening up these civilian corridors. The civilians are only going to come to the Russian side. The Russians may well be worried there might be soldiers trying to hide amongst the civilians, so they're taking them to the Russian side. But it may well be that the Ukrainians are trying to hold up the Russian advance, and it may well be successful if they do that. But it looks like Russia has taken Severodonetsk, which means they've taken pretty much all of the Luhansk region. But this battle for Donbass is still going to go on for many more weeks. Just outside Donetsk here, there's still a huge part of the Ukrainian army. They shelled Donetsk, a massive incoming barrage day before yesterday. So, and that, particularly the fortification of Adievka is a major fortification not far from Donetsk. The Russians are still going to have to take major fortifications in Donbass before they can take the whole of the region.
The British government vows to go ahead with its controversial policy to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda despite criticism and a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. Home Secretary Priti Patel expresses disappointment over the ruling shortly before a plane carrying migrants was due to take off. She insists the order will not deter the plan as a legal team is reviewing the decision and the preparation is underway for the next flight. The plan has already been criticized by rights groups and international bodies, with the UN refugee chief calling it catastrophic. Iran has also called the move a historic disgrace for London. The British government claims it will help stem the flow of migrants via dangerous sea routes. The High Court in London has yet to take a final decision on its legality, but the European Court's ruling is an embarrassing blow to the UK. Journalist Samuel Geddes joins us now from Melbourne to offer us more insight on that story. Welcome to the program. UK plan to deport these asylum seekers to a country thousands of miles away is receiving across the board criticism from church leaders to the UN Refugee Agency and rights groups. Why is the government insisting on going ahead with this plan then?
Well, what the British government is attempting to do is essentially more or less the same thing that successive governments in Australia have been doing for more than 20 years now, which is to create a sense of xenophobically fueled moral panic about asylum seekers, refugees, people trafficking, in order to essentially turn displays of cruelty against asylum seekers into an election-winning strategy. And speaking has proven to be an incredibly effective electoral tactic. Even those that may not be convinced by the pure cruelty of what's being proposed, other people can be won over by the argument that the British government, as well as the Australian government, has continuously made, that in order to deter people from turning to people smugglers, in turning them in essentially concentration camps on another continent is actually the moral thing to do. So by framing it in that way, they are setting this up as a long-term electoral strategy that I would imagine the objective would be to get even the opposition Labour Party to eventually go along with, which is exactly what has happened over the years in Australia.
Well, these people are risking their lives to flee prosecution and war and to get to a safer place. Tell us about the questions regarding the legality of this move and also worries about the fate of these asylum seekers once they get to Rwanda. There's a lot of criticism that the country is not safe for migrants because of human rights abuses there.
In terms of the legality, the body of international law is very clear that any country in which refugees arrive and in which they claim asylum is required to give it to them. The British government has really been giving conflicting messaging regarding its plan to deport refugees to Rwanda, in that on the one hand they want it to be a deterrent that will cause refugees to think again or to not take up the services of people smugglers in the future. On the other hand, it wants to try and present Rwanda as a viable alternative place of settlement for these refugees. So these two attempted justifications are obviously in conflict with one another. Either sending people to Rwanda is a deterrent, or it is a viable place to settle instead of the UK. It really cannot be both.
All right, thanks a lot, journalist Samuel Geddes joining us from Melbourne. Well, moving on, 5 years ago, a devastating fire ripped through a London tower block, killing 72 mostly ethnic minority men, women, and children. Despite an ongoing inquiry and numerous government pledges regarding building safety, residents and survivors of Grenfell say another catastrophe is possible unless immediate action is taken. Amina Taylor reports from London.
Survivors, residents of the community, and wider supporters gathered to remember the victims of the Grenfell Inferno 5 years on. Many had gathered in the shadow of the building that still stands as a constant reminder of June 14th, when an inferno engulfed the tower block, leaving scores dead and thousands of others impacted and the nation traumatized. Dignitaries, including politicians and royalty, paid their respects. And for all the acts of heroism during the blaze and in its aftermath, the scars still run deep.
From my perspective, I feel like it's like a Muslim tragedy in London because of the high number of Muslims that were living here, because it was during Ramadan, because of the impact that it's had on the local community. The very first person who was named was a Somalian Muslim out of the list of people who had died in Grenfell. And I think the continuation of our story right now has to be on recognising the impact it had on the community here and what more can we do now.
The reoccurring theme when you speak with people here is the sense of frustration and anger at the way in which survivors, victims, the community, members of their family were all treated and continue to be treated. The pledges that were made, the promises that were broken, and the spectre of another Grenfell being possible. The official Grenfell inquiry, chaired by Sir Martin Moore-Bick, that so far lasted 4 years and cost £149 million and counting, is attempting to figure out what truly happened and who was responsible. Those still fighting for answers are clear about what justice will mean in this case.
Justice will look like the fact that those people, the leaseholders, people in social housing, you know, in high-rise blocks, are living in habitable, affordable, safe homes. That is what justice will look like on one hand. And on the other hand, as I've said before, justice should look like those who are accountable for, who are responsible for this atrocity, are held accountable.
What I would like to ask this government is, what is it going to take for them to start taking this issue seriously? Is it because the people who died on Grenfell Tower on that night were mostly working class people, were mostly people of colour? Because we know that had Grenfell been in Canary Wharf, that building would not have been covered in illegal flammable cladding. It's utterly outstanding that we're 5 years on, we still have no answers. This community has received no justice, and still there are residents in this country that are living in buildings covered in the same illegal flammable cladding that was wrapped around Grenfell Tower.
Ahead of any official findings, the community of Grenfell march. They remember, and they will continue the fight for answers and justice. Amina Taylor, London.
Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, begins a new campaign for a second independence referendum despite objections from the British government.
After everything that has happened, Brexit, COVID, Boris Johnson, it is time to set out a different and better vision. It is time to talk about making Scotland wealthier and fairer. It is time to talk about independence and then to make the choice.
Sturgeon was addressing a press conference in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh. She revealed the paper that outlines her vision for a future independent Scotland. Sturgeon, who was re-elected in last year's parliamentary election, said people's vote created an indisputable democratic mandate for the Scottish authorities. She's planning to hold the vote before the end of 2023. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has repeatedly refused to grant permission for a referendum, but the Scottish leader says he will move ahead with her plans, even without London's consent. The first referendum on Scotland's independence took place in 2014 when 55% of Scots said no to change the status quo. Now, the global nuclear arsenal is expected to grow in the coming years for the first time since the Cold War. That's according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, which says all of the nuclear-armed states are increasing or upgrading their arsenals. The research body highlights nuclear rhetoric by some states and the role nuclear weapons play in their military strategies. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yani.
Bazaar.
Gathering around food is an ingrained part of almost all cultures worldwide. It's hard to imagine going to a wedding ceremony without its endgame dinner. Many celebratory and ceremonial events include food. Eating is not only necessary for survival, but also it is seen as a pastime and a way to get out with friends and family. For many, it is also a source of income. And the food industry is driven by the tastes of various customers, making it one of the most profitable industries in the world.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week, we venture through Iran's food industry while shining the spotlight on baking equipment. We will explore the industry's national and international markets to get an idea of some of its significant activities. Also, we will touch on subjects like agriculture to understand its role in national food security. So, let's get started. To familiarise ourselves with the types of equipment needed in the food industry, we visited Borac Industrial Company. With 40 years of experience in manufacturing, this company specialises in the mass production of machinery and equipment needed to bake bread. Some of these machines are pretty large and can weigh up to 7,000 kilograms, taking up large spaces in a room. This company has expansive production facilities with high output to manufacture such massive machines. Most of the raw materials for production at this company are purchased from inside the country. For example, the manufacturer buys steel sheets, wires, and plastic components from other manufacturing companies. It then shapes these raw items for the desired machine components in its production halls. This company employs dozens of people directly. It also offers training to its staff to keep up with the various new production methods and produce new machines. In the food industry, competition is driven by high-quality food that comes in a diverse range of attractive products. Lucky us customers. The machinery used to make these items also need to be flawless to produce items that satisfy us, the customers. Consequently, companies expand their product lists to match their customers' varied tastes while introducing new items. So machines are essential to the ecosystem of the food industry. As bakery businesses must adhere to food safety standards, the machines and equipment used to produce food products must match these standards too. Aside from food safety standards, these machines must be dependable with quality assurance. If a machine fails, a baker may not be able to sell their goods, which reduces profits. For this reason, this company also follows manufacturing standards set by the National Bureau of Standards and International Standards for Production. Due to the high yield of this manufacturer, it not only supplies bread-making machines to domestic customers, but also exports its items. In addition to exporting its products to neighbouring regions, it sends its items to countries in Europe, among other destinations. This manufacturer employs industrial engineers and designers to create various machine models. It has also generated numerous job opportunities indirectly. The company has often found a creative solution to the challenges it has grappled with over the years. Some include the availability of raw materials necessary to make its machines. Other challenges are optimizing its marketing strategy to find new customers to increase its reach. However, one of its major hurdles has been the US-imposed sanctions, which have hindered international money transfers, impacting global exports. Speaking of bread making, Iran is a nation of bread eaters. I'm one of them. In fact, official figures show Iranians consume some 160 kilograms of bread per capita. We better keep exercising. That's the highest in the world after Turkey. Many Iranian foods are meant to be eaten with bread on the side. So, Iran produces massive amounts of bread daily to supply this domestic demand. Based on figures from Iran's Bread Association, industrial-scale bread making holds 20% of the market and is mainly handled by machines. However, locally known as naan, traditional bread has more demand and is usually baked in tailored ovens. Around 80% of flour distributed nationwide used to be government-subsidized until this year. Meaning the government was providing part of the costs for flour to be sold at lower prices in the market. One of the reasons for removing subsidies is said to prevent people from smuggling wheat and flour out of the country. On another note, flour is also used in many other foods, which the country also exports. For example, biscuits, confections, and so forth are made in large quantities with a production capacity of around 2.5 million tons annually. That is going off of figures from the National Biscuit, Confectionery, and Chocolate Producers Association. In 2019,
exports stood at $800 million, and in 2020, this figure dropped to around $450 million. Industry participants say this decline was mainly due to the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. Recent figures have not been published yet. The food and beverage industry is probably the most important part of the country's economy, accounting for over 20% of Iran's non-oil revenues. That's according to the National Chamber of Commerce.
Nearly all food products produced in Iran are made from raw materials from domestic agricultural cultivation. That is why Iran has a very robust agricultural industry. However, agriculture is not admitted to farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. Products in this sector are considered strategic as they can be processed into other items, garnering more profits.
Figures from the Ministry of Agriculture show the country has over 18 million hectares of arable land. That's land that can be farmed. Last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced on farmlands. The agro industry is worth billions. Data from the National Customs Administration show the value of agricultural exports rose by 8% last year. Figures show Iran exported roughly 7 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $5 billion in the same period. Industry analysts say last year's exports declined compared to 2020, when the value was around $6 billion. They say there are several reasons for this. One is a government ban on exports of certain agricultural products, such as potatoes and aubergine, to supply domestic demands. This year, however, the ban was lifted. Another reason for the decline in exports is said to be reduced production. This was because of the coronavirus pandemic and less than average annual rainfall, coupled with outdated farming practices. All things considered, this sector has a promising future, particularly with the development of new technology used for cultivation, harvest, and processing. Health is a crucial social and economic asset. It is seen as a cornerstone for human development and the expansion of any economy. It is also considered a fundamental human right. The medical device industry is a sector with the sole purpose of improving the quality of life of its customers. Moreover, it's a source of medical innovation with heavy regulations. As a result, a lot happens behind the scenes before medical devices are released into the market.
We will venture through Iran's medical sector while shining the spotlight on medical device production. We wanted to understand how this sector has grown over the years and uncover who the major players are in this field. Plus, we will look at this sector's contribution to society and the economy.
The capital city, Tehran, has been buzzing with multiple industry exhibits in recent weeks. One of the most anticipated exhibits is the Medical Laboratory Device Show, which drew a lot of participants this year. We visited the expo to see how this market is faring and check out some of the latest developments. We caught up with several companies holding pavilions at the exhibit. Virajin was one of them. It specializes in making machines and equipment used in labs for research and diagnosis. Many holding companies were also present at the show, along with their subsidiaries, who presented their products. But that's not all. The exhibit also provides a platform for getting to know what types of services these holding companies offer.
I should say that we are a holding company, including four different companies. The holding company name is Vista Padina, and the subsidiaries companies are Tubanegin, which is active in fields of molecular biology and life sciences for more than 25 years. And Arya Tashkis Pars, which is active in fields of the tubes for the blood collection from very well-known companies for more than 20 years. And they are one of the main suppliers of the tubes for the laboratories to collect the bloods for the tests. One of our companies is just for engineering and giving backups, after sales service and backup for the instruments. And the other company is Sima Polymer, which they have the production line for the plastic wares of the for the laboratories in different applications.
Thousands and thousands of products were on display here, which are mainly used in medical laboratories. Some companies displayed consumable items used in labs like swabs or thinning liquids. Others produced diagnostic kits. It might be interesting to know that medical diagnostic kits used to be previously imported. However, now with the efforts of research-based firms, many of these items have been indigenized. We spoke with a company that not only has saved the country millions on imports, but also supports various knowledge-based startups.
Exhibits like this one are bustling with people. It's a place where downstream and upstream companies in the medical lab sector can gather and showcase their latest. It also is an excellent place for potential investors to scout out lucrative investment opportunities and check out the local competition. So scores of companies participated in this exhibit this year.
Among these companies were knowledge-based manufacturers, startups, raw material suppliers, and much more. Visitors are given a chance to evaluate and discover the latest innovative products and solutions in the lab sector across all ranges. The exhibit has been put on hold since 2019 due to the coronavirus outbreak. Now it is in full swing again. Medical Laboratory Device Exhibit took place in Iran Mall. It is one of the biggest shopping centers in Iran that also offers an expansive space for trade shows. The coronavirus outbreak is subsiding nationwide due to the extensive vaccination campaign. And now, many businesses are enjoying in-person interactions through this exhibition once again. The goal of the Medical Lab Device Show is to further develop services and products used in clinical labs. It's a place where domestic and foreign participants can interact and strengthen networks. It also gathers medical industry participants, such as doctors and hospital owners, among many others in the healthcare trade. In addition, the Expo is a platform where industry decision makers visit and where scores of business deals are closed.
The exhibition was coupled with a medical lab science and device conference. It was the 13th round of the international conference that was jointly held by the Medical Council and the Association of Clinical Laboratory Doctors. This was a significant event in the field of lab sciences aiming to improve lab services and technology.
Some 2,700 participants from various fields of lab sciences joined the event, either virtually or in person. The five-day conference included 25 specialized seminar panel meetings with international guest speakers among Iranian experts in the field. The purpose of the conference is to exchange scientific knowledge and bridge a dialogue between lab sciences and clinical disciplines. It was also a platform to check out the latest global tech that are being used to improve lab services. Many hot topics were discussed during the conference, such as lessons learned from the coronavirus outbreak. Other discussions revolved around the future of medical diagnostic labs and the technology that will shape them. Industry practitioners say medical lab sciences is one of the most overlooked sectors in the industry, yet it plays a crucial role in the medical sector. Some 70% of all diseases in society are diagnosed by the laboratory community.
all disciplines of laboratory sciences, inducing lab specialists, pathologists, and clinicians were at the forefront of the battle with the coronavirus. These specialists worked tirelessly around the clock to create diagnostic kits, treatments, and equipment needed to combat the disease.
Iran has taken giant strides in the health and medical sector over the past two decades. In fact, Iran's medical device market is growing faster than the world average. The country is globally ranked fourth for engineering over 1,000 medical devices to show for it too. Plus, this technological capacity has allowed the country to churn out advanced devices in the medical sector.
Out of the 1,000 active medical device manufacturers, nearly 230 of them are knowledge-based firms. These companies generate some 30% of revenues in the domestic medical device market. That's all based on figures from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. Going off of data from Iran's Medical Equipment Office of the Ministry of Health, over 2,000 different types of medical devices are domestically produced. All of these meet EU standardization requirements for sales. Also, statistics showed over half of the 500,000 medical devices made globally have Iranian versions, reducing imports by 10%. Iran also exports these items to over 50 countries worldwide, including Russia, Germany, and Italy, among others. The National Medical Device Directorate reported that back in 2018, this market was worth nearly $3 billion. The latest figures have not been made public yet, and this amount is likely much higher this year. The surge in production in this sector is attributed to the hard work of knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Gas powers production, and oil greases the gears of the industry. Without gas and oil, most industries probably wouldn't thrive as they are today. The world consumes around 36 billion barrels of oil per year. Oil and gas are major industries in the energy market and play a significant role in the global economy as the world's primary fuel source. Meanwhile, the process and systems involved in producing and distributing oil and gas are highly complex. They require lots of money and state-of-the-art technology.
Well, it is that part of the show where I should take a break and pass the action over to my very good friend and colleague out there in the field. Take it away.
Metro stations, airports, and stadiums. These are places filled with crowds. So are places such as important military facilities, as well as places such as parliament or embassies. Now, these places are strategic, so their entrance and exits should be observed carefully. In order to do this, some certain equipment are installed in these places. Not only that, this will also facilitate, getting into these places and out of them, provide security. Also, it has an effect on hygiene. So, today we are at a company that produces a sort of equipment that is related to this. Stay with us and let's find out what they have here. Iranian companies used to import these systems from foreign countries in the past. However, this caused some sorts of problem for them. One of them was that whenever their systems needed fixing, it was very costly and time-consuming. Now, this company has provided the ground for long-term services and post-production services for all customers. That includes two-year guarantees for all customers, plus 10-year services for everyone. High quality and reasonable prices. That's the main feature of the products that are manufactured in this company. But why? Well, they can produce equipment with a very lower price compared to foreign models because this is a knowledge-based company. From software to hardware, every nook and cranny of these machines is produced here in Iran. And this enables them to modify their equipment or to produce them in any way they want. And that's the key to their success. A turnstile gate is one of their products. It's designed to be used in stadiums. This company has developed an application for football fans. So what can they do? They can buy tickets online. Then the application gives them a QR code. So when they want to enter the stadium, they just show their QR code and then they go through this gate. Initially, when they designed this, until this company designed this, no other company had the experience of producing an equipment like this. And football clubs back then were forced to import it from foreign companies, and that was very expensive. So this company just understood the market's need and started designing this equipment at a very lower price, but a quality that can compete with foreign models. Today we have visited the first company to produce access control systems in Iran. Their key to success is high quality plus reasonable prices. That's it. So you might ask why. Well, they can produce these equipment from 0 to 100, from software to hardware, all in all, in Iran. And that's what makes them different from others. And that's what makes them stand out. Thank you for watching the show. This was Bazaar's report from this company. See you next time.
Many thanks for that awesome report. Well, we're almost out of time, but before we go, let's have a quick look at the news and trends in the food and agricultural industry. Agriculture and horticulture are two of the major areas which the Ministry of Science and Technology has dedicated support packages for. And these aid packages have paid off with new innovative services and products offered in 12 agricultural fields.
Some of these innovative services include creating online markets for buying and selling products, supplying inputs, and improving agricultural processes. Other technology has been created by knowledge-based companies that are now playing a colourful role in the agricultural value chain.
Farmers are going high-tech as dronology is becoming more common in the cultivation of various crops.
From crop spraying to gathering data, more and more farmers use drones to manage their plots. These flying machines also apply fertilizers, pollination, and even sow seeds in remote regions. Iran's agriculture ministry is encouraging the use of drones on farms by offering soft loans to farmers to help them pay for nearly 80% of purchasing costs.
Well, that's it for today. Don't forget to give us your feedback. And you can also share your thoughts and ideas with us via email. We always enjoy hearing from you. I'm Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must
Open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We spoke about dealing with animals, and we mentioned some of the things regarding what kind of animals should be kept, what kind of animals should not be kept. One way of benefiting from animals is that they are used for means of carrying, for means of transport. That also means that there are certain adab that must be observed when you are using an animal for means of transport or means of carrying. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, ثَلَاثٌ مِن نِعَمِ الدُّنْيَا. There are three things that are of the blessings of dunya. Even though dunya has no blessings, a comfortable, mountable animal. That is comfortable. That's one of the blessings of dunya. And a righteous, pious wife. وَالْمَنْزِلُ الْوَاسِعُ. And a large, expanded house. And a large house. These are three of the blessings of dunya. Imam Sadiq, salamullahi alayhi, he says, ways of a mu'min being happy, or a happy side, a happy element of a believer, is that they have an animal that they are able to mount in order to fulfill their needs and also fulfill the needs of their fellow brethren. وَيَقْضِي عَلَيْهَا حُقُوقَ إِخْوَانِهِ. What a beautiful hadith. So an animal that is mountable, or that can be used for carrying things or for riding, is number one, considered to be a zina, an adornment of this dunya, a blessing of this dunya, and also a way of sa'ada, a way of happiness of a believer. Of course, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi always reminds us that we need to keep that humility. That, you know, although you might have a beautiful, very strong, original breed of a horse or a camel, but he then says, remember that you need to have tawadu and you need to be humble. And he says, let me inform you of five things that if someone was to have them, they would not be a haughty person, a mutakabbir person. And he then says that he mounts he rides a donkey, yarkab al-himar. That's why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would never be ashamed from riding a donkey. He would see that to be a means of showing humility and humbleness. Speaking about usage of and benefiting from animals, you know, we know the verse that in the Holy Quran that says, you know, وَأَعِدُّوا لَهُمْ مَسْتَطَعْتُمْ مِنْ قُوَّةِ. And prepare for them, you know, when you as a Muslim, you're trying to prepare yourself against the enemy. Enemy is attacking you. You need to prepare yourself. You need to be ready in the sense of military jihad. وَأَعِدُّوا لَهُمْ مَسْتَطَعْتُمْ مِنْ قُوَّةِ. You know, here the continuation of the verse speaks about رِبَاطُ الْخَيْلِ, speaks about preparing horses and making sure that you have horses that you are able to use in battle and things like that. Now, in that sense, that might had been, would be applicable in that time. But the beginning of the ayah, وَأَعِدُّوا لَهُمْ مَسْتَطَعْتُمْ مِنْ قُوَّةِ, basically tells us that whatever would be a means of being used to defend the territory of Muslim land, then that should be prepared, whether it be an animal or any other kind of military instruments that would secure the requirements and the needs.
آیت الله جوادی آملی, the author of the book مفاتیح الحیات, the keys of life.
این مفاتیح با دو جلد باشه, چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book مفاتیح ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است, چه فرون نماز و ثواب داره, فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره, دعا هم داره, ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی. اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون, این هم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
There are many ahadith that speak about وَدِينَارٌ يَنْفِقُهُ الرَّجُلْ عَلَى دَابَتِهِ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ, that you are using your daba fi سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. We can understand this in the sense of jihad. We can also understand this in the sense of قَضَاء حَوَائِجْ or حُقُوق إِخْوَانِكُمْ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ, which we've already mentioned as well. And this is exactly what Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says, where the means and methods that should be used as a form of artillery, as a form of military instruments at the time of defending themselves and defending the Islamic territory if needed. Another point is when it comes to the topic of entertainment and sports, and of course sports is good. We've discussed sports as far as it being good for your mental stability, it being good for your physical stamina, and using animals for sport benefits is also something encouraged in Islam. Here, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, any kind of entertainment of a believer is batil, except in disciplining or in teaching a horse and archery and in foreplaying with his wife, which is a kind of entertainment. فَإِنَّهُنَّ حَقْ, these are okay to do. The most loved of lahu, the most loved of entertainment in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is anything to do with al-khayl, with horses, and which means, of course, teaching them, disciplining them, playing with them, warrami, and archery as well. Here, we need to understand there are ad'iyya, there are supplications that are to be used at the time of you when you want to ride an animal, when you want to use an animal for carrying things or issues like that. Another very important point that needs to be mentioned here is when it comes to the issue of wanting to treat an animal in a positive way, when it comes to how you are able to find that level of entertainment, I will mention that in the next episode. But of course, it's an important point in observing certain etiquette, certain mannerism when it comes to the treating of animals. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.